There's no one like the Pope who can really speak to these issues. There's a vacuum that this document inevitably will fill.
Anticipation as we await Pope Leo XIV's first papal encyclical, designed to address both the promise and concerns of artificial intelligence and how it will impact humanity.
The roots of our country are deeply religious, and I would argue the basic principles of the country are inescapably religious.
Bishop Robert Barron goes on the record and defends his work on President Donald Trump's Religious Liberty Commission, his views on the importance of a Catholic voice in the formation of policy decisions.
It's very important for the families that have students with these extra needs.
And as we end one school year and move into the next, we take a look at services for students with special needs in Catholic schools. Are we doing enough in the classroom to help them? EWTN News in Depth starts now.
AI has a lot to offer. It has a lot of danger connected with it, and that the church has a lot to offer in helping to set a good direction so that AI really serves the common good and the human family and the care of our common hope.
What role does Catholic social tradition play in the tech world? And how can AI be used to uplift the dignity of every human person rather than to degrade it? These are the questions the Vatican hopes to answer, and ones Pope Leo XIV himself could address in his first and forthcoming encyclical. Welcome to EWTN News in Depth. I'm Catherine Hadro. The countdown is on for the release of Pope Leo XIV's first encyclical. This major pastoral letter will address one of the Holy Father's top priorities, the expanding and often controversial technology of artificial intelligence, or AI. The encyclical is titled Magnifica Humanitas, on the protection of human dignity in the age of artificial intelligence. Latin for magnificent humanity, the document will be released on Monday. The Holy Father privately signed it last Friday on the anniversary of Rerum Novarum, the groundbreaking encyclical written in 1891 by his namesake, Pope Leo XIII, that addressed human dignity in the age of the Industrial Revolution. When Pope Leo XIII released Rerum Novarum more than 100 years ago, its influence went well beyond the Vatican. Francis Rocha, senior Vatican analyst for EWTN News, says Magnifica Humanitas could have a similar influence.
It's going to get a huge amount of attention beyond the Catholic Church, because there's no one with the stature as a moral authority who can come in and say, and try to frame what's going on and try to suggest the response. So I think there will be a great deal of interest and discussion.
One day after he signed Magnifica Humanitas, Pope Leo approved the creation of a new Vatican commission to coordinate the Holy See's response to AI. The new commission will examine AI's effects on human development, as well as how the Holy See uses the rapidly changing technology. Cardinal Michael Cherney, prefect of the Dicastery for Promoting Integral Human Development, will head the commission.
In order to be attentive to the challenges of AI and to be responsive to the opportunities, we need to be well coordinated within the Vatican. And so our task force is basically to help us to work together on it.
The new commission will include representatives from 7 Vatican dicasteries to better coordinate activities and projects related to AI, as well as policies on its use within the Holy See. One might assume younger generations to embrace artificial intelligence more readily than older generations. However, many college students on their hunt for their first professional job after graduation are becoming increasingly anxious about the opportunities being lost to AI. Reporter Mark Irons sampled student opinions about AI on several campuses in the Washington, D.C. area.
AI, what do you think?
It's definitely here to stay. It's just a question of how we're going to use it.
Pope Leo will address the topic of artificial intelligence in his first encyclical.
The what? Have you heard of that, an encyclical?
I have not.
Do you know what that is?
No.
Are you excited about the encyclical?
What's the encyclical?
A lot of people are asking, what is an encyclical? Makes sense. In this teaching document from the Pope, he'll provide moral guidance for us to consider as AI continues to affect all of our lives. Do you think it makes sense that, like, the Pope would write about this topic, about AI?
I think it definitely makes sense.
Do you have concerns about your own prospects in the workforce with the advent of AI?
I hope not. I mean, I know, like, I saw something about, like, how AI is threatening a lot of, like, entry-level positions that us college students would usually take.
I think we all should be a little bit concerned about AI because it's something new and we really don't have any policy around it.
I don't want to have a job for 3 years and then get it taken over by AI.
I know for recent new grads and undergrads, right, the job market is it's pretty rough.
The rise of artificial intelligence is the next industrial revolution.
Recently, at some college graduations, the commencement speaker brought up the topic of AI, and they were actually booed by graduates. Did you see that?
AI is rewriting production as we sit here. I know it. Deal with it.
I saw the video on social media.
Would you be booing along with them? Would you have booed?
Probably.
I think I tend to be a tech optimist. I think AI optimizes a lot of processes.
AI is going to have a real impact on the medical world. I think it would definitely be a useful tool for us to be able to narrow down, like, possibilities of diagnosis.
Do you have any, like, reflections from your own faith as a Catholic, like the proper way to approach the use of AI?
It's really important to obviously, like, use it with integrity.
Do you think there are moral questions to consider when we talk about AI?
I think so. I mean, with any new technology, there's always pros and cons.
It could be used in many different ways to harm people. It kind of blurs the line between the truth and the lie.
It's definitely something that religion and AI definitely should be corresponded together and just, like, talked about. Humans have the best reaction to other humans. AI is just technology, so you're not going to get the heart and the soul.
Pope Leo is writing a document on AI and its implications and the importance to protect human dignity. Is that something you could be interested in reading? It's coming out Monday.
Yeah, I would be, actually. Yeah.
Right. As a young Catholic yourself, does your faith sort of inform the way you look at this topic of AI?
Yeah, definitely. You really learn in depth about the human dignity and the importance of humans and their nature.
I don't think that there's anything that can reproduce or replace, like, human dignity and human thought. I think God gave us a soul, and God did not give AI a soul. We can't give AI a soul as humans.
So now that you know that this encyclical is coming out, is this something you think you would read? Like, is it something you'd pay attention to?
Yeah, I think so.
You said you weren't sure what the encyclical was. Now that you know what it is, are you going to check it out? Are you going to read it?
I definitely will, yeah.
You will?
It sounds interesting, yeah.
There you go.
And that's reporter Mark Irons talking to college students in the Washington, D.C. area. Magnifica Humanitas will be released on Monday at the Vatican. In a departure from previous encyclical launches, Pope Leo himself will speak at Monday's event, along with lay theologians and top Vatican cardinals, including Cardinal Cerny. You can catch the launch event at the Vatican right here on EWTN. Watch the live broadcast on Monday at 5:30 a.m. on all EWTN platforms. After the launch, watch EWTN's full interview with Cardinal Cerny on EWTN News Nightly on Tuesday at 6 p.m. And join us next week for an in-depth look at Magnifica Humanitas and our Holy Father's moral guidance on human dignity in the age of AI, featuring insight and analysis from our panel of experts. AI tech leader Chris Ola will be a speaker at the Vatican presentation of the encyclical on Monday. He is co-founder of the artificial intelligence company Anthropic, widely known to prioritize AI safety and risk management. He wrote this social media post on X this week about the invitation to appear with Pope Leo at the groundbreaking announcement. The questions posed by AI are bigger than the AI community. We urgently need the world, religions, civil society, academics, governments to participate in creating a positive outcome. I'm glad the Catholic Church is engaging and honored to speak at the presentation. It is possible Ola's presence at the Vatican announcement will become a flashpoint with the Trump administration. Earlier this year, Anthropic refused to give the U.S. military unrestricted use of its technology for fear the Pentagon, under Pete Hegseth, would use it for lethal strikes without a human in the decision-making loop. The government then imposed major penalties against Anthropic, which is now suing the Trump administration, citing what it calls illegal retaliation. From Rome to realities facing Americans, the Trump administration has been vocal on a number of issues concerning religious communities. One place we see that is the president's Religious Liberty Commission, established by executive order a year ago to study the impact of religious freedom on American society. But it's not without criticism. Our commission members, including high-profile Catholic members like Cardinal Timothy Dolan and Bishop Robert Barron, truly free to provide guidance per their religious beliefs if that advice is counter to or critical of Trump administration policies. Our colleague, reporter Colin Flynn, sat down with Bishop Barron last weekend to ask him about his time serving on the commission. Here's Bishop Robert Barron on the record.
When you were approached by the Trump administration and they invited you to be part of President Trump's Religious Liberty Commission, what was your reaction and why did you decide to say yes?
Well, first, I was so surprised because I got a call, in fact, from the USCCB, and they said, the White House is looking for your phone number.
You just said, like, uh-oh. That.
I did. Yeah. I really did.
What have I done now?
The White House? What the? And so I didn't know what it was. So then we found out pretty quickly. I would say my first reaction was very positive. I thought, they're inviting a Catholic bishop to be a voice around a table when public policy on an issue very central to us bishops, we've been talking about it for 35 years now. They're inviting a Catholic bishop to be a voice around the table in the formulation of this policy. Why would I say no? Now, I know all the familiar objections, but see, to me, the overriding thing was, I say no, now we're taking a Catholic voice away from that process. Here's another distinction I'd make, is people have said to me, now you've been in the Trump administration. I'm not in the Trump administration. The Trump administration would be people who are charged with implementing Donald Trump's policies, so like Rubio and Vance and many others. I'm on the other side of that process, if you want. Not implementing the policy. I'm making suggestions regarding the formulation of policy, right? The president could take or leave what we say, right? He could read our report and say, no, I don't want that.
I guess today, because everything is so hyper-polarized in the world, especially in politics here in the U.S., I know that when you were appointed, there was great praise on one side, and people thought this was a great thing to have you on that commission, and then you were being criticized on the other side. People were asking, well, will this affect his ability to speak truth to power?
Why would it? See, my answer is, why would it? Because I'm not on the far side of the policy divide. I'm on the near side of it, meaning I'm there to help shape policy. So I say something. I don't care, in a way. If you don't like it, okay, fine. I'm just making my contribution. Why would I be hesitant or afraid to bring the Catholic perspective to bear? And I'll say this. The commission was great. I spoke my mind in every setting. No one censored me. No one told me, oh, no, you don't say that. And
is it easy then to correct Bishop, to call out, to criticize sometimes the administration if you're on that commission?
I did it twice in the past year, both rather publicly. One was not really a correction, but back in, I think it was November, concern was raised about ICE detainees in Chicago having access to sacraments and pastoral care. And so I approached some folks I came to know in Homeland Security, and I said, I think this is a religious liberty issue. These people have a right to their sacraments and pastoral care. And so, action was taken, and so I raised my voice. Well, that made the front page of the New York Times, member of the president's commission. All right, fine, I don't care. And no one questioned me. No one said, why are you doing that? The second time, of course, was just very recently when the president made, critical remarks about the Pope. And I said in an ex post that I have deep admiration for the president in regard to religion. He's done wonderful things. But I said, I think that was a disrespectful way to talk to the Pope. Mm-hmm. Well, no one fired me so far.
You're sending the job.
Yeah. And, again, it's a comment, in a way, I don't care. I'm on the near side of that process. I'm making my contribution to it. If they don't like what I'm saying, that's their prerogative not to act on it. So, no, that doesn't really concern me. And I've not, been hesitant to say what I think is right.
Yeah, what was your reaction when you saw that Truth Social post where the U.S. president called Pope Leo XIV weak on crime, on foreign policy?
Right.
I much prefer his brother. He's MAGA. He gets
right.
It. And if I weren't in the White House, he wouldn't be over there in the Vatican. It's pretty extraordinary.
Yeah, I thought it was disrespectful. And that's the way I expressed it. Look, when it comes to prudential judgments, can a president disagree with the Pope? Sure. I say in regard to prudential judgment, in regard to a particular issue. Yeah. The president, no, I think you're reading that wrong, and the Pope reads it this way. That's fine. But the Pope is not, you know, just an ordinary hack politician, you know, that you can sort of talk in that flippant way to. He's the vicar of Christ, the successor of Peter. He's our Holy Father. And I just felt that was disrespectful, and I thought it was not a constructive, you know, contribution to the conversation.
It's an interesting question. How should Catholics, particularly maybe here in the United States, view the Holy Father when he speaks about nuclear weapons, about immigration, about war, about things that, you know, international affairs, politics, policies?
The Pope articulates the high principles of the spiritual life and the moral life. And he should always be abided by when he does that, when you speak at those the high level of the great values that ought to be informing our lives. Now, as Aquinas himself said, when you get closer to the ground and moral issues, things get a bit murkier. And then prudential judgment often comes in. And people of goodwill can have different prudential judgments about, well, how best to apply these moral principles in this particular case. And I think there are, you know, people can disagree with the Pope. If he makes a prudential judgment about a particular situation, you say, well, Holy Father, I don't think, you know, it's right for this or that reason. I think that's fine. At the level of principle and the moral values that ought to be informing our life, sure, we abide by what the Pope is saying. But I think there can be disagreement at the prudential level.
It's all about how it's done as well, isn't it?
And that, right,
the
yes.
tone and the approach.
And yes, and that was my objection to the president's post. It was more the tone and the disrespect of it that bothered
well.
Me. Yeah.
Just war. We live in a world today where there are conflicts happening across the globe, the war in Iran, the war in the Holy Land, over in Ukraine, across parts of Africa. And this has been one of the talking points in the Catholic Church recently. When is a war justifiable? Yeah. Especially in the context of people praying for victory and so on and so forth. As Catholics, when do we look at a conflict where there's killing and there's brutality and say, well, this is for a greater cause, this is for a greater good? So in our Catholic social teaching, we believe that this is just.
Yeah, I think we should study that tradition. I don't agree with those that say, oh, it's obsolete, you know, that doesn't apply anymore. I say, no, a fortiori, they apply. I think we should bring them to bear more vigorously. You know, and it goes back to St. Augustine. It's clarified further by Aquinas. It comes up through the papal teaching tradition. And these criteria, I think, are very useful, you know. Is this war truly the last resort? Has everything been tried? Is there a proportion between the destruction of the war and the good to be attained? Is there right intention on the part of the belligerents? Are they going into this for the right reason? And then when it comes to the waging of the war, is there discrimination between combatants and non-combatants? Again, is there proportionality? These are all very useful criteria, and I think the Church's job is to bring these to consciousness and urge political leaders to apply them. You know, the Catechism of the Catholic Church says that when it comes to the evaluation and application of the criteria, that belongs to the civil authorities. And I think there's great wisdom there, too, you know, that in my office in Rochester, Minnesota, I can know the criteria of just war. Do I know enough about the situation on the ground to make the right judgment in regard to them? Well, the Catechism says, well, no, that should really be left to the civil authorities. I mean, I can have my own opinion about it, but I think that's a proper balance. So the Church's job is to bring these criteria to bear and to inform our consciousness about them. And then there are people who are charged with making those determinations.
And these very complex and complicated situations going back for decades, sometimes centuries. And one of the problems is it not that the space where this is discussed now is social media,
yeah.
where everything has to fit in a tweet or a short viral
right.
video?
Yes, and that's a problem. And everyone's an expert.
yeah.
Everyone's got a platform.
Everyone's got their hot take.
Right, and that's not helpful because right, these are complex matters. And serious people, I mean morally serious people, have to be applying these criteria in a way that's appropriate. And that is hard, right, in the constant chatter of the social media conversation.
There was much more to Colum's interview with Bishop Barron. To watch their entire conversation, go to the EWTN News YouTube page. There's much more ahead of this edition of EWTN News In Depth.
What does that say as a faith? If somebody doesn't say yes and says, I will work with you.
Next, are Catholic schools inclusive enough to serve the needs of students with disabilities or learning differences? As parents consider where they will send their children to school next year, we take an in-depth look
at what Catholic schools are doing to meet the needs of students with learning differences.
But I have no doubt that Jesus is real. I have no doubt that he is present with us. And I have no doubt that he is guiding this church to glory.
And later, you may not know this man, but rest assured, your bishop does. We will introduce you to the man behind the scenes, advising Catholic Church leaders across the country on how to improve the church experience and bring more faithful into the pews.
It's very a collaborative environment where I feel like we're a real team. And that's so important, especially when you have children who have autism.
A parent of a Catholic school student who struggled to find an appropriate learning environment for her child, relieved at finally landing at a school meeting her son's needs. Parents like this are often caught in a dilemma. They wish for the full embrace of a Catholic school community with the rich experience that brings for their child. Yet many Catholic and private schools are not equipped to offer necessary services for children with special needs. But there are some Catholic schools that have figured out how to provide a supportive learning environment for these very students. Our Roselle Regis has this Catholic Life report.
What do you love most about school?
I love math.
Meet Shia Moses, a third grader at Queen of Apostles Catholic School in Alexandria, Virginia. Shia plays and learns alongside his peers, but he is not your average student. Shia was diagnosed with autism when he was 4 years old. Shia's parents tell us that they wanted their son to go to a Catholic school, but it was not easy to find one that had resources in place to accommodate Shia.
We visited a number of schools, interviewed a number of schools. It was just really put off by the lack of resources that they was offering for children who was on the spectrum and the lack of integration that they had for outside resources as well.
Moses explains that Shia had an individualized education program, or an IEP, at his previous Catholic school. An IEP is a personalized plan for students with disabilities that include their strengths, needs, educational expectations, and goals. However, no one kept track of Shia's progress, and his IEP was never monitored or reviewed. Public schools are legally mandated to provide services outlined in the document, but this is not the case for private schools. The Moses family is not alone in the struggle. Jessica, who prefers not to give us her last name, said her son John, who has autism, was turned away from many Catholic schools.
So I called 15 Catholic and private schools and they wouldn't even take him. They don't support children with needs, period. They have specialty schools for that, and they said that's where I needed to go.
According to a map on the National Catholic Board on Full Inclusion website, there are only 19 inclusive dioceses in the country, and these are their schools.
The journey tends to begin when a parent asks.
Maggie Hubbard serves as a special education instructional coach for many Catholic schools in Maryland and Washington, D.C., and is part of the National Catholic Partnership on Disability. NCPD recently published a survey asking Catholic school principals and superintendents about their practices regarding students with special needs. According to the survey conducted in 2025, of 213 Catholic school leaders, 58% said they do not receive enough support from their diocese.
What we discovered is that there are pockets of good practices going on, and schools that are committed to it, that want to include students, all students, and do it well. But we also discovered that we have a long way to go. We did get responses that basically said, no, that's not what we do.
Some Catholic schools receive a share of federal funding, such as the Individual with Disabilities Education Act grant. Chicago Catholic Schools relies on this federal grant for their more than 800 students with special needs. So when funding was temporarily cut off last month due to a misunderstanding that has since been resolved, parents were scrambling.
At its root, there's more need than there are funds available. And we're all working to do our best to try to help as many kids as we can.
Some dioceses have partnerships in place to help with funding special education in their schools, such as the Diocese of Arlington, Virginia, which receives grants from Porto Charities. This funding provides diocesan schools like the Queen of Apostles with professional development, special education training, and the ability to hire a resource teacher. Principal Christy Myers tells us they proudly serve 27 students with special needs at their school.
We have this beautiful cultural and neurodiversity school that we've really worked hard to embody the dignity of each child as God created them here.
Shia's parents say he is now thriving at Queen of Apostles.
He's engaging with the other students. He's initiating conversations. And that's a huge growth for him over the past year.
Special education advocates say if there's a will, there's a way. Like here in the rural area of Maryland, we have an inclusive Catholic school. Little Flower School welcomes children with all disabilities and special needs.
This is where we found John, who was provided accommodations and is doing well in school.
The staff is always willing to figure out the best things that they can do to help support him, whether it's changing the classroom around, putting him near a different student that may support him better than others.
Little Flower is also where siblings May and Henry, who both have Down syndrome, are attending school. May and Henry are the youngest of five children in their family. While the three older siblings all attended Catholic school, May had to be placed in public school before her parents discovered Little Flower.
It really just boils down to a school's decision that it's an important part of who they are and what they do.
I'm sure I'm biased, but I think they're pretty beloved here.
2, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. It's 10.
Principal Caitlin Keaton said being an inclusive school has made the school community better as a whole.
Our commitment to this is really rooted in, you know, what the church teaches about human dignity and life being sacred.
What would St. Teresa of Lisieux do, you know? And she would look after the littlest of the little flowers.
To be able to accommodate a total of 36 students with special needs, Little Flower receives grants from the Catholic Coalition for Special Education, a nonprofit organization founded by Francesca Pellegrino in 2004 after her personal struggle with finding a Catholic school for her son Alex. I asked her what goes through her mind when she visits schools and sees other children with disabilities enjoying Catholic school.
It's wonderful. It's just a source of joy because it's what I put my heart into, and now you're going to make me cry. It's very gratifying, and I wish more schools could experience this.
Overall, special education advocates want to see more Catholic dioceses and schools in the country say yes to being inclusive.
Pray. Jump in. The money that you need will find its way to you. The teachers that you need will find their way to you. The supportive community will develop around you. You just have to jump in and do it.
Rochelle Regis, EWTN News in Depth.
Joining us now is Dr. Colleen McCoy-Sika, a former Catholic school teacher and principal. She is the owner and managing partner of Inclusion Solutions, which works with schools across the country to help all students succeed regardless of their ability. She also serves as an executive member of the National Catholic Partnership on Disabilities Catholic Schools Committee. Colleen, thank you so much for being with us. Can you first put into perspective for us, how do Catholic schools compare to public schools when it comes to supporting children with special needs?
Well, it's a big question, and it's a question that is really about what is the purpose of public school versus what is the purpose in the ministry of Catholic education. So you can't really compare apples to apples in that situation. So public schools, sure, they have federal funding. They're mandated to provide educational programming for all students. In Catholic schools, for the schools that are doing really well with inclusion, they really have to find other ways. They really come to terms with their ministry and their mission, and they say, if we truly believe that all children belong, mm-hmm. we have to find a way to do that, because the funding, you talked a little bit in the story mm-hmm. about IDEA funding, and there are mm-hmm. federal programs, and there are ways, but you have to be very resourceful and know mm-hmm. how to work those programs to get what you need for your students.
And Colleen, you authored the study from the National Catholic Partnership on Disability that Roselle mentioned in her report. What surprised you most when you started hearing back from Catholic school leaders on this?
So the most surprising statistic, and actually it was touched on in the report too, and that was for at least the last 12 years, what I had been hearing over and over and what I had seen on the website for the National Catholic Board was that 2% of Catholic schools are fully inclusive, which means that they accept students with intellectual disabilities, including Down syndrome. Almost 18% of our respondents said that they are serving or have served students with intellectual disabilities. Mm-hmm. And so that was something wonderful has happened in the last decade mm-hmm. to see that number jump. There were other, you know, very surprising things about professional development and the way that schools are seeking support and don't feel like they're getting enough support. So surprising, not surprising, mm-hmm. but it explains a lot.
Yeah. And the survey also asked respondents what they needed from their diocesan offices to effectively lead Catholic schools that better support students with disabilities. More than 40% said they needed funding and resources. Colleen, I know this is a big topic. You've already hit on it a bit, but why is funding such a challenge for Catholic schools, and what resources are available there?
So, you know, in the limited amount of funding that Catholic schools can receive from their IDEA and from Title, it's not enough. And I think Greg Richmond said it in the report, too, that there's just more need than there is funding. And that is true everywhere. So funding as the main obstacle. The National Catholic Partnership on Disability actually did about an hour webinar just mm. on that very complex topic about a year ago, which you can find on their website. It is free and available to anyone, because there are all of these different avenues. When we're talking about funding for students, I mean, it could be school funding, so mm-hmm. federal funds and title funds, but parents need to learn how to navigate private insurance, which is tricky. There are also many organizations out there. Well, there are school choice states, so you have ESA programs and tax credit funding and things of that nature that have provisions for students with disabilities to be able to receive more funding. But then there are also those nonprofit organizations like the Catholic Coalition, like Porto Charities, mm-hmm. like ours here in Arizona, the Matthew 1914 Project, all of the fire affiliates throughout the country, that their specific mission is to raise money to help Catholic schools be able to get the personnel, the training, the equipment that they need. All of those things are very expensive. So having those nonprofits support those Catholic schools is incredible. But there are only about 36 of those organizations, and we have over 100 dioceses with schools in them. So we need more of those organizations to come into being.
Mm. Colleen, could you briefly summarize the role that dioceses and archdioceses play in leading and supporting special education in Catholic schools?
One thing that that many people don't understand about the governance of Catholic schools offices and diocesan schools is that schools have subsidiarity. So especially parish schools, they are run by the pastor. They are not necessarily run by the Catholic schools office. And so if the Catholic schools office is there for guidance and support, they can't necessarily mandate schools to do anything. They can provide guidance, support. They can fund programs for schools if they have the ability to do that. But because of the governance model of subsidiarity that most schools have, there isn't governance from the Catholic schools offices over those schools.
That is really clarifying. And Colleen, in the less than a minute that I have with you, can you give us a better picture about what an inclusive education looks like every day for students with disabilities?
Inclusive education is where students with disabilities are learning alongside their neurotypical peers, where all teachers within a building understand the expectation that that there are specific ways to set up your classroom, to design lessons, to design assessments where all students can be successful, mm-hmm. so that we don't have to remove students from the classroom as much as we are right now, but we can universally design education for all children in classrooms. Mm-hmm. That's what it looks like.
Colleen, thank you so much for your work on this topic and for joining us this week. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Putin to China, charges against a Castro in Cuba, and is the Senate ready to push back against the war with Iran? News headlines are next in the Week in Review. Russian President Vladimir Putin's state visit to Beijing tops the Week in Review. It was a quick visit with much pomp and circumstance as Chinese President Xi Jinping welcomed Putin to Beijing on Tuesday night, just days after he hosted his American counterpart for the first time in nearly a decade. Similar to President Donald Trump's visit, Xi rolled out the red carpet for Putin, but the two leaders' meeting was notably friendlier and included an informal meeting over a cup of tea, Xi's diplomatic signal of trust and closeness. And while Trump returned to the U.S. with little concrete to show for his high-stakes meeting, Putin and Xi signed more than 40 cooperation agreements on trade, tech, and media. Analysts note the back-to-back meetings show very different messages, but both are meant to highlight China leveraging itself as a global superpower.
On the substantive difference, I think it's much more clear, right? You see, like, China and Russia reach more agreement, right? And China and U.S., like, what are the agreement? That is even a question we don't even see that clear. I think this meeting elevates President Xi and also China as the major power.
China and Russia have strengthened their ties in recent years. Russia turned to China as a main trading partner after its invasion of Ukraine 4 years ago. And Beijing increasingly relies on Moscow for oil and gas, especially as the war in Iran leaves the Strait of Hormuz in a choke point. A restless Congress appears closer to passing legislation compelling President Trump to withdraw from the war in Iran. The Trump administration launched the war more than 2 months ago without congressional approval, and patience on Capitol Hill is wearing thin as the stalemate in the Strait of Hormuz disrupts the global economy. Under the War Powers Resolution of 1973, presidents have 60 days to engage in a military conflict before Congress must declare war or authorize the use of military force. On Thursday, House Speaker Mike Johnson canceled a vote on a War Powers Resolution, which would rein in the war when it became clear the White House would lose the vote. The House and Senate have now left town for their 10-day Memorial Day recess without passing a major $70 billion immigration funding bill after Senate Republicans blocked a White House attempt to slip in a controversial anti-weaponization fund into the legislation. The Justice Department initiative announced this week would create a $1.8 billion compensation fund for those who say they were victimized by the federal government. That would open up the U.S. Treasury and taxpayer dollars to pay restitution to those who rioted and attacked the Capitol on January 6, 2021.
These people don't deserve restitution. Many of them deserve to be in prison. Some of them deserve the pardon because they were over-prosecuted. But this is, this is just stupid on stilts.
I do not believe that individuals who were convicted of violence against police officers on January 6th should be entitled to reimbursement for their legal fees.
Lawmakers also expressed skepticism about another provision of the anti-weaponization fund in exchange for resolving the president's legal claims against the government for a leak of his tax information. It would bar the IRS from ever pursuing unpaid tax claims against Trump, his family members, or his businesses. Analysts say that could carry significant personal financial benefits, perhaps as much as $100 million to the Trumps. While Congress tries to resolve multiple issues, including the way forward on Iran, the economic impact of the war continues to have global reach. The price of jet fuel has nearly doubled since the start of the war, and airlines are passing along increased operating costs to the traveling public and rising ticket prices. Travel analysts predict an expensive ride as the busy summer travel season kicks off this Memorial Day weekend.
You must book now. It's not going to get cheaper. It's just not. And I'm sorry. It is what it is. The person who waits till the last minute to book their flight is impacted most heavily right now because the prices just keep going up.
She says even when the Strait of Hormuz reopens and oil can move more freely, pricing will not change immediately. It will take months for the jet fuel supply chain to straighten itself out. In the latest escalation with Cuba, the Trump administration has charged former Cuban President Raul Castro, one of the last surviving members of the Cuban Revolution. Federal prosecutors allege he ordered the shootdown of two civilian planes operated by a Cuban-American exile group in 1996, killing four people. EWTN News contributor Alberto Fernandez explains why this charge is 30 years in the making.
It was a shocking case which had political ramifications at the time. Raul Castro has killed thousands of Cubans through the years, but these were three American citizens and one legal resident. So it's been actually out there for quite a long time. It's just it took this administration to actually pursue it.
It is unclear whether the 94-year-old Castro will be brought to a U.S. court to face charges or whether this signals military action in Cuba, similar to the Trump administration's capture of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro in January. The administration has put increasing pressure on Cuba since then, including an oil blockade that has worsened the island's energy crisis. Cuba condemned the charges on Castro, calling them an act of political provocation. We'll be back in a moment.
He sees his work at Catholic Leadership Institute not as a job, but as a mission and a vocation.
A growing influence in Catholic dioceses in America. We talked to Dan Salucci, the counselor, confidant, and advisor to bishops across the country, helping them shape our Catholic Church into the future.
Welcome back. When it comes to the church hierarchy, who's helping to lead our leaders? While he may not be a household name, Dan Salucci has become a trusted figure in chanceries across the U.S. As president and CEO of the Catholic Leadership Institute, Salucci has earned a reputation as a bishop's counselor, a confidant and advisor, helping our U.S. shepherds behind the scenes navigate some of their most consequential decisions. I spoke with those who know Dan Salucci best to get a better idea of his and the Catholic Leadership Institute's growing influence on the U.S. church.
I immediately, felt that this is really a faithful disciple of the Lord.
Bishop David Toops of Beaumont, Texas, has known Dan Salucci since his days as a priest in Florida. Today, personal friends, they first met through the work of the Catholic Leadership Institute, where Salucci serves as president and CEO.
Dan is one of the most diligent, hardworking, always available as a when I was a rector of a seminary and now as bishop. If I have a question, I can always get him.
The Catholic Leadership Institute, or CLI, exists to help every leader of the church, whether a bishop, seminarian, or layperson, by providing ongoing formation, parish support, strategic planning, and beyond. Since its launch in 1991, CLI has advised roughly half the U.S. bishops, worked with almost 150 dioceses in the U.S. and Canada, and had about one-third of U.S. diocesan priests go through its formation program. I spoke with members of the clergy who have become close friends with Dan Salucci through his work to get a better sense of his influence behind the scenes and inside parish halls.
I describe Dan Salucci personally as a close friend and a guide and a mentor, but also an incredible gift to the church.
Archbishop Nelson Perez of Philadelphia says the Catholic Leadership Institute helps bishops integrate best practices into their parishes and is an especially great resource for newly appointed bishops.
We're not made bishops, we're appointed bishops, and with that we need a lot of help, and we're really only as good as the people that God graciously places around us.
Bishop Toops agrees. For
instance, I arrived here in Beaumont, Texas. I knew no one. I literally knew no one. No priest, no chancery staff. Who can you bounce ideas off that is going to give you objective feedback? So I think CLI has seen themselves helping to fulfill that role.
CLI and Dan have continued to call the church to a degree of professionalism and accountability, but more than professionalism and accountability is hope.
Father Paul Soper is the Secretary for Ministerial Personnel and Director of Clergy Personnel for the Archdiocese of Boston, one of the largest in the country. He's known Dan Salucci for about 15 years and says his work with CLI helped the Archdiocese navigate tough times and tough decisions, including parish consolidation.
Dan and CLI were there ready to say, this is okay, we're going to make it through this, and here's how.
Those years of prayers and strategic planning are now paying off in Boston.
The places where young adults are gathering, not only on our university campuses, but all around the city of Boston, are exploding with Catholicism right now.
Archbishop Perez in Philadelphia has tapped CLI to help bring back 83% of baptized Catholics in his archdiocese who no longer attend Mass, and as part of the initiative, announced the establishment of 5 parish-based missionary hubs, which Salucci has helped shape.
We have to be forward-facing, outward-facing, and that's really the essence of the missionary hub. It's asking the question, where does the church need to be and how?
While each diocese, parish, priest has a unique set of challenges, CLI strives to stay nimble to those specific needs.
You name it, they're really able, and literally you name it, and they can put something together to help us, to help bishops and priests and dioceses to accomplish whatever it is they're really trying to do.
As we've just heard, the millennial father of four, Dan Salucci, has walked alongside many of our church shepherds with a unique point of view into their daily struggles and decision-making. To hear more of that invaluable insight he's gained, I recently sat down with the Catholic Leadership Institute president and CEO in our Washington, D.C. studios. Dan Salucci, thanks so much for taking the time to speak with me today.
This is a privilege for me. I'm really grateful, Catherine, to be here. Thank
I'm really
you.
Grateful. I have heard you referred to as the bishop's counselor.
Ooh.
So what do you make of that name and reputation?
Well, that is an honor to hear. I don't know if it's that incredible, but I have had this privileged position to walk alongside some of our bishops over the last 20 years that I've been doing this ministry. And so for me, you know, they're the successors of the apostles. I mean, I think sometimes we forget that. Mm-hmm. And that weight is tremendous. And so what we try to do, what I try to do when I get to walk alongside them is just let them share where they are, what's on their heart, where they feel God's calling them, and then help them think through the steps in order to get there, in order to take those steps to where the Lord is calling them to be.
And I want to hear more about that. I mean, you have worked with over 300 bishops and more than 120 dioceses in the U.S., and that's of the 196 that there
yes.
are.
Some in Canada, too, but yeah.
There we go.
Yeah.
We'll get that Canada mention yeah. in there as well. You've personally worked with most U.S. bishops today. What have you learned about the church during that time?
Yeah, I have learned so much, but I think what I've learned first and foremost is we're in great hands. Mm. These are good men. They are called by God to this incredible role. They are humble men. I really have yet to find the bishop who wanted that role, and I think that's really important to remember. You know, as a CEO, there was always some part of me who wanted to kind of get there, and that ambition, we might say, is good. In this case, these men are obedient servants who are responding to a call that's very daunting. And that's the other thing I think I've learned is just the wideness, the breadth of the portfolio that our bishops are really responsible for when you think about it, in their teaching, in their governance, in all the different responsibilities they have. I don't think we can really appreciate just how wide the portfolio is and all the things that are coming across their desk.
Yeah, so many different areas of expertise that they're just required to have.
Sure. Think about the real estate on one hand. Think about things like gender ideology on the other hand. I mean,
yeah.
that's...
Yeah.
You know, I have a very particular focus. I can kind of become an expert in that particular focus, but theirs is even 10 times wider.
Looking at your work that you do, walking alongside our bishops in the church, I mean, you have had to recommend some very difficult things
sure.
to our shepherds, hard truths to our church leaders, whether it's on bankruptcy, church consultations or closures, counsel on caring for and responding to survivors of abuse. Has this affected
your spiritual life, Dan, and how you see the church?
Yeah, that's a really great question. It has made me come closer to Jesus. I get to see, as you kind of reference, some of the ugly parts of our earthly church. I have been able to experience the church personally, pastorally, in a way that just tells me that this is no accident. This is no outdated institution. This is a divinely inspired reality that we get to be a part of. And it has all sorts of bumps and bruises here on earth, but it is constantly growing in heaven in the communion of saints.
You know, many of these bishops who have been appointed by our Holy Father. It's still early, but are you seeing certain trends or shared characteristics among these appointments?
Yeah, well, I think it's important for everybody to know that we are entering into one of the largest transitions of Episcopal leadership in our country.
Tell me more.
More than half of our dioceses, 70 dioceses in the United States, are going to change hands in the next 5 years because we have a lot of bishops who are coming to retirement age. So this is just a fact. So what one of the things I noticed is just the speed at which the appointments are happening, which I think is great. The other thing that I noticed, which is really interesting to me and I think speaks to probably what I can what I've observed about the Holy Father, a lot more bishops are coming from their home diocese. So they're either maybe the auxiliary bishop or the administrator currently, and then they're being elevated to the ordinary. I think that's speaking to Pope Leo's, you know, really wanting these bishops to know their people, to know what is needed pastorally, to know how these shepherds need to guide their flocks. And so that's, I think, an encouraging trend that I'm seeing already early on in this pontificate.
Yeah. Do you think we need more young people injected into lay leadership in the church? I mean, you look at the lives of the saints, and so many of them were just on fire so early on in life.
I do. I think we as millennials and Gen Z need to step up more. I think there's also a reality that some of our older generations, and God bless them because they are the backbone of our parish, but sometimes there's the need to maybe step aside to let a young person take the reins and do it the way they're going to do it, as imperfect or different as
and
that might be.
Uncomfortable, that change might
very
be.
Uncomfortable, right? But it's almost, it's important that transition happens so that they can take ownership over these communities. Right now, they're making community, in many cases, outside of our parishes. And I don't think we want that for the long term. So,
are there any other signs of what a healthy, thriving parish looks like?
We found four things that distinguish and define a parish that is thriving versus one that's declining. That parish has a really thoughtful plan for the spiritual maturity of their people. They understand everybody's at a different place. And they're helping to say, okay, how are we going to help the folks who are at this place take the next step? Two, the laity, as we were talking about earlier, they share the responsibility too with Father. Father has an incredible role, an essential role, but we have a role too. We can't put everything on his shoulders, and we have to rally around him. We have to give him support. We have to go out on his behalf and on the church's behalf. So this culture of shared leadership is also present. The third is we have to be intentional and reverent with the Sunday Eucharist. We have to put our best foot forward in what we say is and is the most important, the source and summit of our lives, because that's where we're going to be experiencing most Catholics every week. And the last is what I think Pope Francis really John Paul II, Pope Benedict, Pope Francis, and Pope Leo have called us to, which is this missionary impulse. We have to have eyes open and looking outward to who are the souls who we can connect with? Because the church has responsibility for all souls, not just those who are coming, not just those who are even baptized. We have a responsibility for all souls. If we think about our discipleship that way, what does that compel us to do, right?
Can you just leave us with a thought about the importance of vulnerability for all of us as we're reaching out to others and in our effort to evangelize?
Yeah. The metric, you know, I'm a leadership person, so the metric of success, right? We always talk about what's the metrics of success. Our metric of success is a man who hung on a cross. That's what we look to when we say that's success.
Yeah.
But in my experience, when other people as a leader have embraced their brokenness and have realized that there's some brokenness that we can't fix, that we need a savior, that allows all sorts of things to happen. And so I think we need to model that it's okay to be broken, that he's here for our brokenness, and that he's the one who can fix it, who can heal it. We can't sometimes.
Dan Salucci, thank you so much for your witness and for your work for the church. Thank you.
A great blessed be with you. Thank you.
My thanks to Dan Salucci for sharing his wisdom with us. You can watch the entire interview on the EWTN News YouTube page. We also discuss his recent private audience with Pope Leo and more insights into what makes a thriving parish. And finally today, an invitation to watch an EWTN News special commemorating the anniversary of the destruction and then astounding rise from the ashes renovation of the famed Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris. Here's a preview.
When Notre Dame burnt, the whole of Paris was in tears. Young men, young women gathered close to the statue of St. Michael and were on their knees praying the rosary and crying, saying, it's not just a building going, it's our history, it's our tradition, it's our identity, it's our faith, it's our trust in the Blessed Mother. And suddenly all of France gathers, the billionaires and the poor, I mean the men and women, the French and those who love France and all who love our faith, and they gathered together and people from all parties came together as one, and that's what really brings a nation together. And we built it again, and we see it again, and it's so unbelievable that this pyre is from 2024. And you look at it and you're like, well, France is not dead, and our faith is alive. We build cathedrals, we send missionaries to the world, and we can do it again.
Correspondent Colm Flynn takes us to Paris for another look at the renovation of one of the world's greatest Catholic cathedrals. His special report, The Rebirth of Notre Dame Rising from the Ashes, airs this Monday at 6 p.m. Eastern and will also be available on the EWTN News YouTube page. And that's a wrap on this edition of EWTN News in Depth. I'm Catherine Hadro. We hope to see you again same time next week for more news and reports important to your Catholic life. Until then, God bless.